Tax Committee, back to order, members. Senate File 3352 is a bill that that I introduced on durable medical goods and sales tax. It changes, makes some things that are currently not taxable taxable, makes some prescribed devices not taxable. So we've got some advocates that want to come up and testify to the bill. They understand the issue better than I do. So, Mr. Amberg, do we have some people that want to come up and kind of speak to where the what the problem is, where we can't get reimbursements, and how this bill might change that? Ooh. And members, there is in your packet from Dr. Wilson over at Revenue an email from him that came last night. We had requested a fiscal note on this some time ago, and we've received just a confidential draft one. So you can look at Dr. Wilson's memo if you'd like.
My name is Jackie Anderson, and I own Key Medical Supply in Shoreview. And Jack Windhorse from Dorsey Firm is our attorney on this issue, and he's going to give some background on it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Windhorse. I'm with the Dorsey and Whitney Law Firm, and I'm representing Key Medical, Jackie Anderson's company, as well as the Minnesota chapter of the Midwest Association for Medical Equipment Services, which is a group composed of 54 businesses that sell medical equipment to Minnesota institutions and patients. Senate File 3352 would change the two elements of the present sales tax exemption for various types of healthcare products. These are two items that have created problems for medical equipment suppliers when they sell equipment for which payment is made by third-party payors, such as Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies. Until recently, the Department of Revenue held that transactions covered by Medicare and Medicaid were not subject to the sales tax. The department also held that all repair and replacement parts for durable medical equipment qualified for tax exemption. Both of those positions have changed over the last several years under unusual circumstances, and those position changes have caused problems for the industry because taxes have been imposed upon sales that they make but cannot obtain tax reimbursement on from their customers. One of these reversals occurred about a year ago when the Revenue Department announced in a fact sheet revision that items paid for or reimbursed by Medicare and Medicaid would no longer qualify for tax exemption. That announcement was not based upon any change in the statute, but simply on a change in interpretation of existing law. The other change occurred about 2 years ago as a result of a statutory amendment which denied exemption to repair and replacement parts for durable medical equipment if those parts were used by a single patient, which is true of many of these parts, and therefore had a substantial impact. It's not entirely clear, but we believe that the legislative change that occurred 2 years ago was a result of action taken by the Streamline Sales Tax Group, which actually offered states an option either to tax or to exempt these single patient use parts. But the option that was exercised in Minnesota was to tax them, although it's also our understanding that there was no revenue estimate attached to that adoption, because the Revenue Department may have been under the impression that those items were already being taxed in Minnesota. But in fact, as the department recognized about a year later, about a year ago, in a fact sheet, that 2008 amendment did change Minnesota law. That is, prior to 2008, these single patient use parts were not considered to be taxable. And so the result of both of these changes, the Medicare-Medicaid change and the single patient use change, has been that members of this industry have been subjected to Revenue Department audits in which assessments have been made based upon the fact that they did not collect or remit tax on these transactions. Now, in addition to the fact that these two changes occurred under somewhat difficult circumstances or uncertain circumstances, they also created collection problems for the industry once they fully became aware of the changes, because third-party payors, whether they're Medicare or Medicaid or private insurance companies, typically have a fixed price schedule at which they pay for items of medical equipment. And they are generally unwilling to deviate from those schedules in order to pay sales tax. And so the industry finds themselves in the position of being audited and assessed tax, but unable to recover the tax from the purchasers. And this result, of course, flies in the face of the theory of the sales tax, which is that the seller is authorized and, in fact, required to collect the tax from the buyer. And in this case, the buyer and the buyer's third-party payor are not paying the tax. So Senate File 3352 would change both of these results by exempting Medicare, Medicaid transactions, and also by exempting single-patient use parts used in the operation of durable medical equipment. There is also a provision in this bill to generate revenue by applying the tax to durable medical equipment, prosthetic devices, and mobility-enhancing equipment when they are not purchased under a prescription. The Streamline Sales Tax Group, again, offers states an option to tax or exempt equipment of this kind or to tax it if it's prescribed, but or to exempt it if it's prescribed and tax it if it's not prescribed. Minnesota, when it adopted the streamline proposals generally in 2005, opted to exempt all of this equipment, whether it was prescribed or non-prescribed. This bill would propose to impose the tax on non-prescribed equipment, and the rationale for that has several elements to it. One is that when the equipment is purchased without a prescription, there may be less medical necessity for it. A second factor is that when equipment is purchased without a prescription, it is generally paid for by the purchaser rather than a third-party payor, and so the tax is more readily collectible. And a final factor is that if you look at the streamlined sales tax group, of the 23 states in the group, about half of them tax this equipment when it's non-prescribed, and another eight tax either one or two of the three categories of this equipment when it's non-prescribed. So there is precedent within the group for making that distinction.
Mr. Windhorst, thank you. Members, if you look at the revenue estimate on the back of Dr. Wilson's letter, this indicates that in FY11 this would raise about $2.2 million. Ms. Cadoon, anything the department wants to speak to here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would like to, I guess, discuss this a little as well. Just to make a few points regarding the law changes that occurred. There was updates, obviously, with the streamlined sales tax, and we agree with Mr. Windhorst that these are options that the state could do. So by making this change, you will not be out of the streamlined sales tax compliance. However, that bill originally for the adoption of these durable medical equipment and provisions, the bill was first introduced in 2003 and then adopted in 2005. There was then consideration at that time of items that should be adopted or not based on the streamlined sales tax. My understanding is that you looked at provisions and really tried to minimize the revenue impact of adopting these streamlined sales tax. So there are some trade-offs that occurred at that time. And so that's why you have the law as you now do. At that time, the 2005 change, then my understanding is that when the changes dealing with the Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement and billing issue would have been that was the modification at that time. What was mentioned regarding the recent change to the fact sheet is really the fact sheets are updated on a kind of on a continual basis. If you see there is issue or confusion regarding some, for example, from some audits that are occurring, you see this problem or some confusion from taxpayers, the department then does go in and update fact sheets because you want to make sure that taxpayers are educated on the subject and don't continue to make that same mistake. And so that's why you saw a recent change in a fact sheet regarding the durable medical equipment and this tax issue was just regarding that it was really back to that 2005 law change, but that's why you saw a more recent update to the fact sheet. Now, Susan, maybe you have some additional comments to provide some more clarity to the committee on this issue.
Yes, I'm Susan Berry from the Department of Revenue. As far as the change that was made in 2008, so that for the repair and replacement parts for the durable medical equipment, the definition from streamlined sales tax was then included, and we did the state did pick up the option to say that the repair and replacement parts for the durable medical equipment would not include those parts for single patient use only. Now, before this, repair and replacement parts for durable medical equipment were also exempt if they were for home use. However, the department had taken and continues to take the position that for all of these products, the prosthetic devices, the durable medical, and the mobility enhancing equipment, that the repair and replacement parts for those, while they would be exempt, they do not include disposable items that are used in conjunction with the equipment or devices, nor do they include single use. And we've always taken the position that the single patient use, whether it's multiple uses or just one use, that would be included under an umbrella of being either disposable or single use, so that they would not be included as repair and replacement parts. So when we adopted the language to say that the repair and replacement parts would include the attachments or components used in conjunction with the durable medical equipment, but not those that are used for single patient use only, the department considered that a status quo. And that's, from my understanding, that at least that was at least part of the reason why the revenue analysis was a neutral.
That was the department's interpretation, yeah. But is that in practice what happened?
No. I can state unequivocally,
Ms.
no.
Anderson?
Yes, Jackie Anderson from Key Medical. The Medicare and Medicaid and third-party payer exemption is huge. That's about 90% of what any DME company does. The change that has been referenced was nothing that was published. So the industry is still and was, until audits started occurring, under the impression that Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance sales, third-party sales, were exempt. The language did not come out into the public until the sales tax update in 2009, April of 2009. So we are exposed to audits from 2005 when the law changed forward, unless we get this changed. And I can tell you that it is huge dollars for small businesses. We've had to lay people off. We've had to lose positions in anticipation of paying a tax that we cannot recover. We've talked to the Department of Human Services here in Minnesota about creating a separate code for sales tax so that we could add that to the claims and recover it that way, and they have refused to take that position. The language in the federal law that governs pricing states that all of our administrative costs have to be included in the claim. So you've got the cost of the product, the price of the product, plus your administrative overhead, including sales tax. So that's a great theory, but the problem is that if you've never collected that, if there's no history of that, then you do not have the historical basis for those price increases. And so what we have here is a price compression. We have reimbursement reductions coming from all sources, Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies. Reductions sometimes upwards of 20%. So there is no room for that tax to come out of us, which in my view would be a use tax and not a sales tax. The premise, as Jack said, of sales tax is that the purchaser pays it. So if we were in a retail setting, if the purchaser refused to pay the sales tax, they wouldn't get the item. But in our case, we're delivering products to people's homes, and we're sending in claims, and we're getting reimbursements up, 15 to 30 days later. And so the payer sources that control that are saying, no, we're not going to pay sales tax. So that leaves us with either a de facto price decrease or a use tax. So we feel that's extremely unfair. The other characterization that the Department of Revenue has taken on items is just not the way that the products are actually used. And I want to give you one example of this single patient use. When someone is fed enterally, they cannot digest food, they cannot take food through the mouth, they have to be fed through an opening in their stomach. There is a device that's put into the stomach, a G-tube, for the delivery of the food. But in order to get the food to them, there are other devices that have to go along with that. Now, these are all wrapped together as part of the prosthetic benefit under Medicare and Medicaid and insurance companies. That's how it's looked at in the healthcare world. Revenue and the streamlined sales tax has included these as single-patient use items attached to the durable medical equipment, for example, the pump that delivers the food, or the IV pole where you have to hang the bag where the food goes in. There's a tube that comes out of the bag that delivers the food into the G-tube. Now, all of those devices, you may not know it to look at it, but they take the place of the digestive tract. And so that's how the food gets into the body. And in healthcare, you do not want those types of items, of course, being reused by other patients. Those are all single patient use. Almost everything in healthcare that's an attachment to a DME item or a prosthetic is single patient use. Those things now are, according to Department of Revenue, taxable. It's not right.
I agree.
Senator Scheid, do you agree?
I agree with her.
Ms. Kadoon, is there... I mean, I think the providers make a strong argument here, but is there a way to resolve this issue without running afoul of the governor's bright line on calling this a tax increase? Is this a compliance issue, or what do we have here?
Well, Mr. Chair, for the bill, I believe when you get the revenue estimate, I know the preliminary numbers were showing a net increase, and I think if you look in the bill as it currently states, it would be a net revenue increase. Within the bill, though, you have some items that would now be taxed that aren't those prescribed items that you see in the first part. So those are the revenue raisers in the bill. I think you wouldn't necessarily need those items. I don't think they have to be combined together is what I'm saying. You have a couple items that are revenue losses to the state because items that are currently taxed now, and they added those other items as a revenue raiser. So I don't think you need necessarily all those combined together. So it could be, if you're just trying to address their situation, you could just have the exempting some additional items.
And Ms. Kadoon, how long would it take for the department to score that for us if we asked them to take out the revenue raisers and just score the exemptions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that's what they are working on right now. They've already scored the revenue raiser portion, and they're working on the items that we're going to lose revenue.
Think we could have it by Monday?
I'll check on that, Mr. Chair.
If I could just make one other point here. The other thing about the bill talks about this issue that you were just addressing. The way that revenue has put out the tax bulletins, the items that are needed under a medical prescription and for a true medical condition are taxable. The items that you go into the store to purchase, and they may, be needed medically, but they're not under prescription, so they would be under more of a convenience category, are exempt. So it is absolutely topsy-turvy in my mind. Where the tax could be collected, they are exempted, and where they cannot be and where they are truly medically necessary, they are taxed.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm being a little bit facetious, perhaps. We should be taxing like $795 pairs of shoes or more, $1,500 dresses, $2,000 suits, but we're talking about nickel and diming people who need this equipment actually to stay alive. I just, it just hit me kind of between the eyes about what we've done here. I mean, apparently we've already done it.
Yes.
Wow.
We are exposed from 2005 forward, apparently.
Wow.
And didn't learn about this change until audits, field audits, started occurring.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I'm understanding, so all of these items were supposed to have been taxed, and 90% of your business is with Medicare and Medicaid, and they just said we're not going to pay sales tax on these?
Correct.
They
Sanderson, so I understand, don't either.
They would pay the sales tax if it would have been built into the price of the product?
That's correct.
But because it was not, there's no way to go after them after the fact?
That's correct. But you have to understand also the price compression that's occurring right now. The reductions in reimbursements are so severe that even if tax had been built in over time, there's not enough profit to cover the tax. And we service all of Minnesota and some of Iowa and Wisconsin and so forth, and you've got variable tax rates. Sitting in this session this morning, you know, there were several communities that came in for their community tax add-ons. So when you add those factors in, there's no way for a fixed price schedule to accommodate a fluctuating tax.
Wow.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cadoon. How does Medicare and Medicaid, I get the compression and reimbursement, so the money's not there. I'm just really struggling with how the government or an organization would just ignore our sales taxes. We said that they had to pay sales tax. How do they just say, well, we're not going to pay them? And that's what I've heard her say. Medicare and Medicaid and these insurance companies are saying, well, no, we're not going to pay the sales tax. How do they do that?
Well, I think, Senator Skoy, Ms. Anderson, didn't Minnesota's Department of Health and Human Services say the same thing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They wouldn't reimburse for the tax?
That's correct.
But when they go to buy paper for their office, they pay the tax.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You have to understand, too, that we have operated in Minnesota with Medicare and Medicaid and insurance sales exempted from this up until apparently this change in 2005 that no one knew about. The bulletin that discussed this was not published until April of 2009, and I'm convinced it was done after we went through our audit and challenged the Department of Revenue on how we could be forced to comply with a rule we didn't know about.
Man.
Well, Ms. Anderson, I think the committee agrees with you. I think the question is going to be, what's the cost going to be?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that I don't know how the Revenue Department scored the legislation in 2005, but if the tax was never collected, I'd like to see how they did that. You know, where did they pull those numbers from? And what's the basis of saying that it was neutral if it was never there?
Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe if you go back and look at the revenue estimate for the streamlined sales tax in 2003 and then what was adopted in 2005, there certainly was a revenue estimate put to those items. So that change in 2005 did not score as a revenue neutral bill. What I'd said is that the bill, there was trade-offs that were adopted at that time on what you'd tax and not tax under the options given in the streamline in order to minimize the overall revenue impact, but there certainly was pluses and minuses within the revenue.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schreid.
Mr. Chairman, the question comes up in my mind then. How much of this revenue how much did you collect compared to what you thought you would from 2005 forward or whenever it went into effect?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I don't think we have that analysis. Go back and look what the original estimate was and then what we're currently collecting.
So,
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask Ms. Anderson, what did you say the kind of dollar amount you're looking at? Or, I mean, you don't need to if you don't want to. I assume if it can cost an employee, it's probably pretty extensive. And if it's somebody buying, I don't know if you sell the little scooters and things, mm-hmm. but that kind of stuff is pretty pricey. And if that...
We haven't done an estimate on everything on the single patient use basis, but we're looking at somewhere upwards of about $150,000 plus per year tax over what we were operating on before. It's huge. I mean, it's absolutely huge. And there are some providers that are looking at numbers that are even higher than that because they deal with the items that are durable medical equipment with single patient use attachments and not being able to recover that. So we're looking at thousands of jobs losses because of this, thousands. And businesses probably closing because there just isn't the margin there to cover this kind of thing.
Sure.
Not to mention the fact that it's a sales tax that's uncollectible.
I understand.
So why is that a penalty for the business?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make the point that when we're talking about single patient use only, we're not talking about the durable medical equipment itself that's for home use, you know, such as someone who's using a scooter. Although that actually wouldn't be a DME, that would be a mobility enhancing equipment, which is already currently exempt. But we're talking about the repair and replacement parts, which the law says are the components and attachments that are used in conjunction with the durable medical equipment. So we're talking about like the masks and the, like you said, like the feeding tubes. Those are the kinds of things that we're talking about here.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Schein. Mr. Chairman, I think those are pretty expensive. I mean, because if they are, they're single use.
They're single use, and the feeding equipment, for example, has 24-hour hang times recommended by the manufacturer. Yeah. So even though it's used on a single patient, it is used several times in one day. The point, though, that I think revenue is missing is that you have the piece of durable medical equipment that can be cleaned and refurbished and used over again. But the attachments that go with it have to be by necessity single patient use. You don't want to use the oxygen mask that I just used. There's no way to get the bacteria out of it. Those are the single patient use items that are absolutely necessary for oxygen equipment to be delivered to the individual. And this is what revenue is now trying to tax.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, when they say revenue is trying to tax it now, obviously we're trying to follow the law as it currently stands and obviously make sure that taxpayers are educated to that law. So we're only trying to tax items that are currently stated in law should be taxed.
Senator Skoy.
And thank you. And Ms. Kandun, how does the department view this statement that this is uncollectible? That's what I can't get my head around is we've, you know, put a tax in place and the business is sitting here saying that it's not collectible at their level, and the only way that the tax can get paid is if they take it out of their operational budget. I don't understand how we could be doing that as a sales tax.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I guess I don't know enough about the reimbursements by Medicare and Medicaid as well as through the state regarding this equipment. So I really couldn't comment on the collectibility of it or not.
Seems like at a minimum there's kind of two issues here. One is the back taxes that people weren't even aware they were supposed to be collecting that they didn't collect, that they might have been able to be reimbursed for if they had known they could have built it into the cost of the product. But I'm less concerned going forward than I am trying to go back when somebody had no awareness they were supposed to have built the cost in. But, Senator, is there any way for us to get out of this box that
we're in here, we I think we're...
Well, I don't know what you can do legislatively, retroactively, but, you know, certainly that would ease that issue for the industry. And going forward, you know, we're hoping that this legislative change that we're proposing is adopted, and that would take care of going forward. It's going to be a huge issue, and so any recommendations that the committee or members can offer us, we certainly are happy to take. I don't know what the answer to that is. I know that there's going to be a lot of stress in our industry, a lot of jobs lost, and a lot of businesses closing. I know that.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Anderson, I mean, these patients are still going to require this supply. Is they're just going to get it from some company out of state then? Is that what will happen?
Possible. The banks aren't really lending to small businesses just yet. So, you know, if the economic crisis wasn't on top of all of this, there may have been an opportunity for most of the providers to go to the banks and get some loans. But, you know, it's hard to make up that kind of money. It really is. Mm-hmm. And so the only way to do it is taking it out of your highest operational costs, which unfortunately is your people.
Well, let's see what the fiscal note on it is when the department gets us something and see if we can figure out some way to pay for it.
Gosh, yeah. Man.
Is Kadoon, anything further?
No, Mr. Chair. We'll try to get you that revenue estimate as soon as we can.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, then that would mean you'd be looking at what you have received, what taxes you have collected so far since this was implemented, right? I mean, it seems to me if we're going to talk about a cost in a fiscal note, we should actually be basing it on experience as well.
I think they haven't
as theory.
I think they haven't collected anything yet. Well, is that right, Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair, Senators, I do not know how many people in this industry have complied with that law since 2005 or not. So I'm not. I don't have the background to be able to tell you one way or the other, but we do obviously for revenue estimates we assume compliance with our tax laws, even if it hasn't been collected at this point or remitted. Obviously, we're in audit situations now and going through that process currently.
But Mr. Chair, it would be useful to know what we have collected. I mean, they do know that, I'm sure. I mean, I understand you don't have that number here, but they would know. Not necessarily.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I can certainly check in to see if we have any of that information. I would, I'm not sure if we'd have it by product to that much of a detail when somebody remits their sales tax. I would be surprised, but we can certainly check into that for the committee.
Do we know how many businesses provide these kind of supplies?
Our MAMES membership is 55, and we believe that there are probably about 200 businesses in the state of Minnesota. Most of them, you have to realize, are about $500,000 to about $1 million in sales. So they're very small businesses, and they typically service a very small geographic area. So we're trying to get a handle on exactly how many there are, but that's our belief. Most pharmacies have some kind of small medical supply aisles, and so you've got a lot of pharmacies that do incidental medical supplies. But the types of things that I'm talking about, the oxygen and the feeding equipment and so forth, we believe that that number's around the numbers I gave you.
Do we know how many of these businesses we've audited?
Mr. Chair, I wasn't privy to that information, so I don't know.
Question two.
Thank you. Ms. Kadoon, let's try to do a little work on this today and tomorrow and see if we can figure something out here within the money constraints that we have.
Thank you.
Ms. Anderson, thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 3352. Senator Dibble? Dibble, which one's first?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to take Senate File 2919, TIF bill. TIF for Todd. TIF for TOD.
Senate File 2919 is in front of the committee. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 2919.
TIF for Todd.
I've had similar discussions in front of this committee a couple times now, Mr. Chair and members, about this idea. And I bring it to you again with some new ideas, perhaps. Maybe we'll be more persuasive this time, or more persuasive of the other body as well. Simply put, Mr. Chair and members, what this bill seeks to do is to create a new form of TIF district. We call that a transit improvement district. And the definition for that you find, Mr. Chair and members, on page 2, section 2. It provides some of the parameters of what a transit improvement district is. The boundaries, its size, its proximity to the key, of course, is that it's proximate to a transit stop adjacent to certain kinds of transitway facilities that, of course, were beginning to build in the metropolitan area, more of which will be coming in the coming years. The transit improvement district would be similar in conception and construction to a redevelopment district or housing district, a housing district or a redevelopment district. So it would have similar duration and it'd be construed similarly. And then the uses for a transit improvement district, for those increments, Mr. Chair, you can find on section 5, which is also on page 5. And we identify 8 purposes, possible purposes, that a municipality could use those increments for: acquiring or constructing or improving the transit station itself, the green space related to transit improvements, streetscape improvements, such as improvements to the streets and sidewalks, the public right-of-way, really creating those kinds of districts that are walkable, that are compact, that have the kind of public realm amenities to create these vibrant nodes around transit stations that we're seeking to create that really maximize the use of the land use and really attract and site the kind of development that we're seeking that support transit and are supported by transit. For the purpose of operating paratransit or circulator systems that support that transit line, established already in state statute a loan program that we did a few years ago. We established that as a program. We never found any resources, didn't have any resources to put into that. That's administered through deed, through the Public Facilities Authority. That's what paragraph 5 is about. Item 6 is in support of that program, implementing the transit area improvement plans that are developed by municipalities and authorized by that commissioner. The other new idea, we're looking very strongly, City of Minneapolis and others, at developing streetcars that serve neighborhood level service. Streetcars are little trolley lines. They wouldn't be operated by the regional transit system. They wouldn't be construed as a state a transit system, but they would really be operated within cities for the purpose of inner city mobility. The other cities that have started doing that, and the federal government is starting to provide matching dollars to start to build more streetcars in dense urban environments around the country. And part of how they've built those and operated those is with some of the adjacent increment from the improved property values. It specifically excludes, as we have in the past, we've been pretty adamant about not supporting the capital or operating for the other more large-scale sorts of transit lines, the LRT, the bus rapid transit, commuter rail, intercity passenger rail, et cetera. With that, Mr. Chair, we have a couple of folks who can also help explain what other areas around the country are doing, why this is a desirable way to proceed, trying to build the kind of development around and along transit lines to maximize that public investment that we make in transit in our cities.
Senator Dibble, I see a resolution from the county about encouraging the development of a community works Does the county have a position on creating a TIF district around these developments?
We just invited the other in the House committee. Commissioner McLaughlin did.
It's kind of a separate issue.
Right. Mr. Chair, I don't know if the county has a formal position with respect to creating TIF districts for this purpose. I do know that Commissioner McLaughlin, according to Peter Wagenius here from the city of Minneapolis, testified in favor of this. I don't know if that was he speaking on behalf of the county or?
I don't know.
Okay. So some commissioners like it. We know
that. Some like it, some don't. Or
I haven't heard any opposition. I don't know if they have a formal position in support of TIF districts for this purpose.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jim Urkel with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. At least in terms of transit or using TIF for transit-oriented development within the metro area, it would only the cities through which a transitways corridor runs could take advantage of it. Those have been identified by the Met Council. The counties have taken part in that planning process. It also would be funded through the county transit improvement board, and the counties sit on that board. They run it, and so it would only really take TIF could only be used in the metro area if the counties really wanted it to happen.
That doesn't answer your question. I know. I just don't know if Mr. Chair, if Hanson County has taken a formal position with respect to
Senator Dibble, I think that would probably be helpful. I see there's a resolution here of support from the city, but the county tax portion, the tax capacity the county's going to give up is significantly higher than what the city would give up. I think it just might be helpful for us to know that.
All
this
right.
is potentially a lot of, potentially, I think, a lot of development that the capacity would be lost.
We'll tend to that. So I have some testimony, Mr. Chair. Jim Urkel is here. I think, you know, the question has been before the committee. You know, the fundamental question that we've attempted to answer and we'll try to answer more fully in this presentation is the but-for question. You know, we make this transit investment. Why doesn't the development that we're talking about occur of its own accord? And some think it should, and we think it does not. And I think the evidence in practice from other regions and some of the shortcomings that we've witnessed already in our own community with respect to the existing transit ways that we have really point to the need for this device. We have Jim Urkel from the Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I am Jim Urkel with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. I'd like to start by apologizing to the committee staff because I put together a PowerPoint presentation, shot it over to them, of course not realizing that there was no way of showing it. So I apologize, but I did cram a lot of information into the presentation. I'm not going to walk through it. I will try and just hit the highlights. Transit-oriented development is an integrated approach to both land use and transportation. It's characterized by compact and mixed-use forms of development in and around transit stations. It's proven to be economically beneficial both at the household level and at the regional level. At the household level, it allows residents to reduce their travel costs. It also, by taking advantage of the transit line that it's associated with, they're able to access employment opportunities throughout the region. At the regional level, the transit-oriented development helps reduce a number of different forms of air pollution, by reducing the amount of vehicle miles traveled. It also makes the regional investment in transit much more efficient. It's a mistake, though, to think that transit-oriented development just happens on its own. There are a number of reasons why it doesn't. In a lot of places, land use regulations need to be changed because at the moment that compact mixed-use form of development is illegal as a matter of right in order to try and get it built. There are a lot of site conditions that make it difficult. Private capital is a little hesitant to invest in mixed use. They know how to invest in commercial properties. They know how to invest in residential. It's the mixed use form of development that's somewhat bothersome to them. Investing or financing public improvements within the area is one way of priming the pump for transit-oriented development, and one of the funding streams that has been used to do that is tax increment financing. There are a number of examples from around the country in the presentation. I tried to show examples of transit-oriented development on commuter rail lines, not unlike North Star, on light rail lines like Hiawatha, on some of the stations that are more suburban in character, like we will probably see on Southwest Light Rail down in Eden Prairie. Tax increment financing has been used to support transit-oriented development in Minnesota. The Fridley North Star station used some TIF, and Bloomington used tax increment financing at their central Bloomington station as well. The problem is its use is limited because of the mixed-use character of Todd doesn't really easily fit into the existing forms of districts that we have. Other states have had the same experience, and a number of them have recently established a new form of tax increment financing district specifically to support transit-oriented development. Pennsylvania started off in 2004, Texas 2007, Maryland and Maine just last year. The bill, as Senator Dibble explained, would establish a new district for Todd or for transit-oriented development. It would set out a menu of options that cities could choose from to fit their own circumstances. It would apply to cities through which the transitway corridors run, and those have been identified by the Met Council. It would also allow cities to set up sub-regional streetcar operations as well. Other than that, the bill does not change any of the procedural protections in how districts are established, such as the requirement that cities consult with counties prior to the establishment of the district. The opportunities for the public to engage with the cities in planning for how the increment could be spent, and for the reporting requirements that assure both transparency and accountability for cities in the use of the increment. The Southwest isn't there yet. So, thank you.
Mr. Urkel, thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have Peter Wagenius from the City of Minneapolis.
Something like that, yeah.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. Peter Wagenius from Policy Director, Bear Ryback's office, City of Minneapolis. Members, the likelihood of bringing federal transportation funds back to Minnesota for modern streetcar projects has dramatically increased in the past few months. In January, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood eliminated the cost-effectiveness index as a pass-fail test for transit projects. That was a primary impediment to streetcar projects being eligible for federal funding. The stated reason for doing so was almost as important as the fact that he did so. He said, when making this decision, eliminating the CI as a pass-fail test, that he was doing it to move popular streetcar projects forward. This motivation wasn't reported that much locally because there was a specific impact which dominated the local news, which the same decision also allowed St. Paul and to get three stations back that had been eliminated from the Central Corridor LRT line. In many cities across the country where they didn't have that local angle dominating the news, they were focused on the main thing that the Transportation Secretary had talked about, which was about streetcars. Cities across the nation, regions across the nation are responding. They are racing to get in line for federal money for streetcars. In March, four projects already got there. Four streetcar projects received federal Tiger grants for construction of their streetcar projects: Dallas, Texas; Portland, Oregon; Tucson, Arizona; and New Orleans, Louisiana. There is nothing, members, nothing inherently superior to those other states' projects compared to projects and proposals that could come from Minnesota. The reason that those states have been able to bring federal dollars back to their states and we have not yet been able to do so here is A, they took streetcars seriously earlier, and B, they put together the local matching funds with local tools, most commonly value capture tools like the legislation before you. Two other quick points, Senators, and Jim Merkel would also be able to speak to this. The jobs and economic development impacts of streetcar projects are extraordinary. If you've been to the city of Portland and you've seen their streetcar projects, you know that they created a neighborhood out of nothing, a very popular neighborhood out of a former rail yard. Lots of housing, lots of jobs. I would just add that these projects are unlikely to happen in Minnesota if local units of government have to choose in identifying matching funds, have to choose funding streams that compete directly with police and fire. That's never going to happen. Having balanced the budget in the city of Minneapolis 12 times in the last 8 years, if we had to make that choice, it's never going to get made. Specific tools just for these purposes are necessary.
So, Mr. Chair, we had a few other folks who were on tap to testify this morning, but I'll just convey their regrets. Councilmember Russ Stark from St. Paul, Councilmember Elizabeth Glidden, who also serves as the IGR liaison for the City of Minneapolis. Peter McLaughlin is in D.C. From Hennepin County. So they send their regards and indicate their support for this initiative as well. I'll stand for questions. I know there's a couple of amendments. One of them, Mr. Chair, I know Senator Senjum was interested in offering, so maybe I can offer that on his behalf. That's the A2 amendment. So, Mr. Chair, what this would do is Senator Senjum brought this subject up, and it's an excellent point that he brought up in the Finance Committee. This actually started off in Transportation Finance and had to balance to the full finance on its way here. And that is, what about Greater Minnesota? Greater Minnesota, of course, if they want to put in a streetcar. Otherwise, these other kinds of transit service are fairly specific to the metro area, LRT, BRT, et cetera, operated by the Met Council. But passenger rail, as it pulls into town and whatever town that may be in the future, there's going to be a transit station where that passenger rail line pulls in, and the opportunity for this kind of development around those kinds of transit stations, transferring modes, folks coming together to access that particular rail service as well. Is a pretty rich opportunity. So with that, we wanted to be sure that we weren't excluding opportunities in other regional centers that might be receiving this form of intercity passenger rail service.
We're broadening the bill quite a bit, Senator Dibble.
Excuse me?
We're broadening the bill quite a bit.
Indeed, Mr. Chair.
Wasn't that a good idea to start with, Senator Schott?
Oh. No,
wow. Oh. Senator Syndrome's not here. Well, we'll put it on for him. Senator Dibble moves the A2. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion prevails. A2 is adopted. Is there another one?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moi.
Maybe I should have Senator Dibble offer my amendment and not be here either. Mr. Chair, of the A1 amendment.
He's weighing it down, Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment, I think Senator Dibble has seen this amendment, and I've had a chance to discuss this with him.
Thank
and
you.
It's I don't know that it necessarily broadens any, but it just adds to the pooling exceptions that we've had about spending outside of the allowing pooling expenditures spent outside of the district, and so it just adds the transit improvement areas to those exceptions. And it just gives a little bit more flexibility. And, Mr. Chair and members, the language on the second page of the amendment looks like it's talking about biotechnology and health science industry zones, but we're actually not adding a brand new exception. We're making changes, I guess, to that area of the statute, and so the language is just being added here for clarification. I think that's what it is, right, Ms. Zoff? I hope that I hope I'm saying that correctly, because I had a question about this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mwai, you're correct in that the references to the biotechnology and health sciences industry zones are just a way of restructuring this, so this single provision will apply to both of those types of districts.
Correct.
And that was an existing law.
Correct.
So, Mr. Chair, we have Pat Nauman here who can speak specifically to this idea, but also to the underlying bill from the Metro City's perspective. I'm comfortable. I think this was a part of a proposal that I had last year. I talked about using increments for this purpose. Some of the idea was, of course, not everything that we need to do along these lines just exists at the actual station. No, some of it we need to get into other parts of the line other parts of the community that particular line is serving. Some of the idea of doing this pooling.
Ms. Nauman, you want to speak to the A1?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We represent 80 cities across the 7-county region, and we do support having flexibility in the TIF laws for transit-oriented development, both expressed in this bill and the bill that Senator Dibble has carried for us previously, which did contain the pooling concept. And essentially, I could echo what the previous testifiers have said, but we're really looking at just having additional tools. We don't think that optimal development around transit stations occurs without really careful public planning and resources directed at trying to make sure that we maximize the return on the public investment in transit. So that's why we support having these additional local tools available.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, we hope you've been overwhelmed and really would like to include this bill in here. Your bill, your larger bill, that you roll out.
I don't remember, Senator Dole, this has been discussed in the conference committee with the House previously. I'm trying to think about kind of what their position was on it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would think it would be safe to say that the chair of the other body, tax committee, is not a big fan of TIF.
Mr. Chairman.
I do know they had a hearing. So she has her kind of normal, standard set of five issues that she has with TIF. I do know that she wasn't as skeptical of this year's proposal as she has been in past. That's what I understand from my co-author.
Senator Shide.
And Mr. Chairman, considering the conversation here a couple weeks ago about the low-income fuel credit, I think we're on a roll, so I think we should keep going for it.
I haven't actually spoke to the House tax chair since jobs bill passed. So I'm a little nervous about getting this bill loaded up to the point where she'll decide we don't need a bill at all to go to conference and talk about. So,
well, Mr. Chair, if I can speak out of school a little bit, I did have a conversation with the person in question during the interim, and I think she's trying to figure out some stuff along these lines that works. I don't know if we have the magic here, but we're making progress.
Okay.
I feel pretty strongly about this, though, Mr. Chair.
Chair lays over to Senate File 2919 as amended for possible inclusion in the committee bill. Senator Dibble, I'm just trying to minimize the number of things that we have to argue about with the other body, but we'll have a discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'll do what I can to grease the skids for you there.
Would be helpful if you could
absolutely
kind of clear the path for us.
Absolutely. I'll find the way.
One last bill, members. This is Senator Dibble also, Senate File 3055.
My gum will fall under this.
Again, Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to present Senate File 3055, which we are referring to for the time being until Senator Betzel or someone strikes the title, the Tobacco Modernization and Compliance Acts of 2010. I like titles, but I know it's not the Senate tradition. So for the time being, until someone gets to us or one of you gets to us, stakes that out, that's what we'll call it. Mr. Chair and members, I do have an author's amendment. If we could, the A2 amendment.
Senator Dibble moves the A2. Senator Dibble, do you want to walk through the amendment, or would you like counsel to?
Mr. Chair, maybe we can put it on, and then I can walk through the whole bill. If you don't mind.
On Senator Dibble's, on the adoption of the A2 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. The A2 is adopted. Senator Dibble, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. By way of just quick introduction to what we're trying to accomplish in Senate File 55. We're trying to do exactly as the title describes, modernize our tobacco statutes and make sure that all forms of tobacco products that are coming to the market are in compliance with our regs and our way of dealing with them in the marketplace. Mr. Chair and members, we'll have a little show and tell here in just a minute. We have quite a few new products that are showing up in the marketplace coming from the tobacco companies, and some of them are really geared towards delivering the ability to consume tobacco in ways that I never even heard of or dreamt of. They look a lot like little lozenge strips, little candies. Some of the products are very colorful and fruit-flavored and sweet-smelling, and they really seem to have a real focus and target on kids. They are every bit as addictive as more traditional tobacco products. The other development we've seen are this ability to try to construe what are essentially and effectively cigarettes as cigars, and I think once you see them, you'll agree with me, because of the way our definition works, and that is, if there's any amount of tobacco in the material that wraps the device, then that's considered a cigar. It could be a paper, but some tobacco is mixed into that paper, and so we call it a cigar, and that way they get to dodge the more traditional cigarette taxes. And so we're trying to really close some loopholes and make sure we're providing for the standard set of protections that we have for youth access, et cetera. I'll walk through the bill very quickly. Of course, Section 1 is the title. Section 2 with the amended language provides a new definition of what a cigarette is, so that we're capturing those what are cigarettes that are now being called cigars. Section 3 provides a new definition for what a tobacco product is, and the key words are derived from tobacco intended for human consumption, whether chewed, smoked, absorbed, dissolved, inhaled, snorted, sniffed, ingested by any other means or any component, part, or accessory of a tobacco product, including but not limited to, et cetera. So that gets us, these little dissolvable strips that you put on your tongue, these little pills that you take that dissolve in your mouth, et cetera, so that we're being a little more proactive in capturing what a tobacco product is. Section 4 We've actually deleted in the office amendment, and that has to do with the fire safety provisions for cigarettes because we have some difficulty complying at this point. I think we'll need to come back to that at some point in the future. So Section 5, which is now the new Section 4, provides for some of these restraints of trade provisions, making sure that products aren't being offered below cost, making sure that we're not undercutting the market. Section 6 has to do with the samples, the single servings, the samples, the free samples, et cetera. We have some restrictions on where and how those can be provided. Doesn't include tobacco shops. Section 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 have to do with local authority and local units of government and their ability to now include tobacco-related devices. Those are the e-cigarettes and some of their, those are the kind of the battery-operated nicotine delivery cigarettes, but they're not actual cigarettes. They're made out of metal. We have an example of those. We'll see those in the show and tell as well. So selling those e-cigarettes to kids, providing for the penalties, providing for the compliance check authority, providing for the affirmative defense provisions as well. The new Section 12, which is in the author's amendment, has to do with making sure that these products are also subjected to the open shelf prohibitions, that tobacco products aren't just simply placed out on the open counters next to candy. Some of these things look like candy, like I said before. We want to be sure they're not actually put on the shelves out in the middle of the convenience store next to candy. Section 13,
cigarettes.
I'm just going by the numbers that are in the original bill. The sections have been renumbered with the author's amendment. Have to do with the variety of youth access protections, and so we're updating the definition for the array of youth access protections that we have, including the tobacco-related devices and the e-cigarettes. And then Section 14 works with the Department of Revenue, asked them, and we've worked with them on this language to develop a study and report to the legislature on how we unify our tax collection system and how we make sure that we're providing for the best possible system to deal with tobacco products. And all of the elements of that study are outlined, making sure that we're providing a unified system of collecting those taxes, discouraging tax evasion, preventing the illegal sale of tobacco products. We inserted an additional provision in the author's amendment to prevent the counterfeiting of the tax stamps. We do a review of our existing system, survey best practices in other states, et cetera. That's the high-level overview of the bill, Mr. Chair. We have Kerry Gordon from Clearway, Minnesota, who can present a little more information about where this bill has come from and why we think it's important.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And maybe a page could come for the show. Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 3055. My name is Kerry Gordon, and I am the Senior Public Affairs Manager for Clearway, Minnesota. Clearway, Minnesota is an independent nonprofit organization that was founded with 3% of the state's tobacco settlement in 1998. Our vision is to eliminate the harm tobacco causes the people of Minnesota. I'm also speaking on behalf of the coalition of organizations supporting the bill that include the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, the Association for Nonsmokers Minnesota, Health Partners, and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, among others. I should also mention, as Senator Dibble mentioned, that we did work in close consultation with the Department of Revenue, Division of Special Taxes, on the tax-related portions of the bill. So just as you'll see as the product samples are coming around, the tobacco industry and the tobacco products that we're seeing in today's marketplace bear little resemblance to the tobacco industry and products of my parents' generation or my grandparents' generation. And really the laws and regulations governing these products were crafted for the 20th century and don't fit very well for the 20th century or 21st century products, that we're seeing in the marketplace today. So essentially our laws have not kept up with the rapid pace of change in this sector. For example, as Senator Dibble mentioned, little cigars, we think have been misclassified in statute for years, resulting in incorrect taxation, evading the requirement to have tax stamps and other youth access regulations. In addition, some of the newest generation of tobacco products, like the dissolvable tobacco, are not even contemplated in our laws, which allow them potentially to escape all tobacco taxation and youth access regulations. So the bill before you today is a common sense, we think, almost housekeeping measure that will bring Minnesota laws in line with the rapidly changing environment. So just quickly to go through some of the products that you're seeing and what the bill would do is first addressing the problem of little cigars. As you'll see, little cigars, for all intents and purposes, are cigarettes. They come in packs of 20. They have internal filters. They're about the same size and length as traditional cigarettes, and they're often advertised and perceived, confused by consumers as cigarettes. So this is kind of the example of if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it really is a duck. And so holding up, and I think there's a little baggie on the tray that shows how close these are. Why would a traditional pack of cigarettes cost between $5 and $6 a pack? And this pack of Remingtons was purchased for $1.19 in Minnesota. So what is the difference? And the difference is, as Senator Dibble mentioned, there's a little bit of reconstituted tobacco in the paper of little cigars that allows them to be considered an other tobacco product instead of a cigarette.
So, Ms. Gordon, is there anything different about the tobacco inside the wrapper?
It's a strip.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not an expert on that, so I'd have to defer to someone else to answer that.
We'll get a chance to find out.
I think it's important, though, that consumers who are purchasing these products, see them, view them, consider them to be cigarettes. So our definition, allows these to be treated differently than large traditional cigars. When they clearly are quite different. This is a traditional cigar. This is the little cigarette. We even have a cigarillo that would be similar to a Black and Mild or I'm not sure where it went, but
my little box.
Oh, okay. And of course, there's some advantages to little cigar manufacturers for the fact that they're classified or keeping things as status quo, and those advantages are that tax stamps are only required for cigarettes in the state, so at this moment, these packages are not required to have tax stamps, and the difference is pretty significant for a pack of cigarettes. The state tax is $1.56 per pack. Doesn't matter what the wholesale price. For little cigars, it's 70% of wholesale price. So if we assume that this wholesale is for a dollar, that's only 70 cents. So almost half of what the state tax burden is on these products. So a pretty significant difference. And so that's the result, is that these are available widely throughout the state, extremely cheap. And the other thing I'll mention is that these products are allowed to evade the federal ban on flavored cigarettes. And so what you'll see is that there's flavors, cherry, peach, grape, strawberry, vanilla, bright colored packaging, and obviously these are chocolate, my personal favorite, in that these are clearly not being marketed or targeted towards a mature, older smoker who's been smoking for decades. So there's a lot of concern that the fact that these are extremely deeply discounted, they're widely available, and that they're candy-flavored and appealing to kids, that it's not only a problem for youth smoking, but also for tax compliance statewide. The second major portion of the bill, and I do want to be clear that, and with the author's amendment, we are only seeking to get a change around the products that come in packs of 20, the little cigars. We are not doing anything that would impact whole leaf, larger cigars, or cigarillos. And we think that the changes that we made in the author's amendment do that.
This would be, Mr. Chair, the Swisher Sweets, the Black and Milds, those sorts of things. So not affecting these.
How about out back?
Hmm?
What are they called? The ones that come in the paper bag, backwoods, or?
Oh, I don't know that one.
I'm not familiar with that one. Really,
it's not my little collection.
Yeah. We're really going after the things that, you know, that have the internal filter that really are function as a cigarette, everything except for the color of the paper. That's what we're intending to solve. The second problem the bill seeks to correct is the newest generation of products that are not even currently contemplated by our laws, our tax laws, or our youth access laws. And the best example is the Camel Orb sticks and strips. And these are made of super finely milled tobacco. They're dissolvable in your mouth. They clearly, as you can tell, I'm sure many parents in the room, they have large amounts of nicotine in them, so they are addictive. They're easy to conceal. They're discreet. You know, so that you can see as a parent or an educator, there'd be a lot of concern, you know, that a child could be, or, you know, a student in class, in math class, and there's no way some of the traditional things that parents would rely on, a kid showing up smelling like smoke, don't exist with these types of products because they're so discreet. And so I should mention these are not yet in the state, but this bill offers us the opportunity to get ahead of the problem by going ahead and expanding our definition. It clearly shows the direction that the industry is heading as a whole in terms of in reaction to smoke-free spaces. We're seeing a big push towards smokeless tobacco products. So this is an excellent opportunity for the state to get out front of the product, out front of the problem before they do come to the state, and we could conceivably see a kid go down to the corner store and purchase these next to the M&Ms and gum and candy because there would be no regulations around them at this point. And finally, as Senator Dimble mentioned, we're seeking a path to address what we think is an issue, and we think that the Department of Revenue is also identified as an issue, is most folks don't realize that the only products, tobacco products in the state of Minnesota that are required to carry stamps are cigarettes, traditional cigarettes. All these other products, smokeless tobacco, do not require tax stamps at this point. And so we would just like the Department of Revenue to study that issue and see if they can make a recommendation to the legislature to come back with a more complete and secure taxation system for all tobacco products. So just to quickly finish up, so while we think that, you know, there's some housekeeping measures in this bill, there are some significant consequences if we don't take action quickly, and that's namely getting some of the protections in place that we think are vital to protecting kids and others from these cheap and available products. So regardless of maybe some of your positions on other more controversial tobacco issues, we think that this is quite a few common sense steps that we can take that the majority of Minnesotans would support in order to ensure that there's proper tax compliance across the board and that our kids are being protected from these products. So thank you for your time and consideration. And I didn't pass around the e-cigarette, but we can. This is what Senator Dibble was referring to.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I just wanted to, you know, obviously this study is going to cost some money. I don't know how much exactly. Department of Revenue can probably give us their best estimate, but we do this compliance, particularly around the little cigars, raises a little bit of money, and those are the resources that we're looking to use for the study.
Shouldn't they be included things into the tax?
I'm told by our fiscal analyst that we've requested a fiscal note on the cost of the study, but
right.
We don't have it yet, so. Assuming we'll have it tomorrow.
Give me this.
Any questions, members? We've got some other testimony, I'm sure. Senator Squay?
Senator Dibble, how about my Nicorette?
Mr. Chair, thanks for asking that question, Senator Squay. The nicotine replacement, where is that?
It's in the tobacco product section. It's specifically.
If you look at section 3 and the tobacco products definition, I think towards the end of that paragraph on page 2, starting on line 8, tobacco products excludes any tobacco product that has been approved by the the FDA for sale as a tobacco cessation product, as a tobacco dependence product, or for other medical purposes, and is being marketed and sold solely for such an approved purpose. Thank you.
Ms. Gordon, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Does anybody else want to testify in support of the bill? Thank you. I know, I believe you've got some people that have got some concerns, and then I want to hear from the department as it relates to the governor's position on whether this would be considered a tax increase or not. He's got a pretty bright line for us. So let's start with the people who've got some concerns about the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, a trade association of tobacco wholesalers here in the state. Senate File 3055 is a bill with a solution that's in search of a problem and attempts to enact regulations that are technologically not possible. The provision, even as amended by Senator Dibble, to require that most little cigars be classified as cigarettes and stamped with a cigarette tax stamp is technically impossible. I have passed out to you a page which shows a picture of the standard cigarette stamping machine that's used by wholesalers to affix the state's cigarette tax stamp to cigarettes. What that machine does is you put a carton of cigarettes at one end. It opens the bottom flaps of the carton. It then heat applies the cigarette stamp to each bottom of each pack, refolds one flap, glues it, and then reseals it and presses down the second flap, and it comes out the other end. Those machines are only made for uniform-sized packaging of cigarettes. I understand that Senator Dibble and the representative from Clearway showed you some packages of little cigars that are very similar in size. Some of those may be able to be stamped with the cigarette stamping machine. However, even as amended, some of the little cigars that would have to be stamped would not work through the machine. For example, Al Capone's. This is a small pack of 10 little cigars. Some Swisher Sweets may also be impacted. These Cafe Creams, it's a metal box of 10 small little cigars. Individual little primetime tubed little cigars. They may fall under the definition of a little cigar as amended. They could not work through the machine. It'd be a technical impossibility to stamp it. There are literally hundreds of brands of little cigars on the market. They're not like cigarettes. They're not uniformly packaged. They come in all different sizes of packages, and that's why it would not be feasible to stamp them under Senate File 3055. However, we do think that there are several provisions of the bill that are prudent and you should be considered. One is that would expand the definition to include these new kinds of tobacco products. This is one of them. It's an Areva dissolvable tobacco tablet, and it's made of finely ground tobacco. My wholesalers currently charge the 70% other tobacco tax on this product. It retails for $4.59 in retail stores. Your current tax structure works with this kind of product. We're already collecting and remitting that tax to the Department of Revenue. Also, we agree with the provision that you should include these new electronic cigarettes. They look like a cigarette. They have a lithium battery and a chamber of nicotine and water vapor. And when inhaled, the nicotine and water vapor come together through an atomizer, and there's nicotine ingested by the individual. What is exhaled is water vapor. That is a tobacco product. We believe that should be included so that stores don't sell those to minors, and minors are prohibited from purchasing those as well. However, we do disagree with a couple of provisions. One is in the amendment that Senator Dibble spoke about, and it changes the definition of tobacco products. It says you can't have self-service displays where a customer can access the tobacco product of tobacco or tobacco-related devices. That's not what the prior law did. The prior law allowed self-service displays, particularly of cigars and pipe tobacco. Those are truly personal items. And for cigar stores and traditional tobacco stores, like I also represent, customers want to pick up and feel those cigars, smell them, taste them, and go into the humidor and purchase those themselves. So I know we have to work with Senator Dibble to try and change that language, and we'll certainly be willing to do that. The current tax system is very efficient because the licensed wholesalers collect and remit to the state $427 million in cigarette and tobacco taxes, health impact fees, and sales taxes each and every year. But we believe that the study that is included in the bill is not a good idea for another reason. It looks like it's designed to extend the stamping requirement not only to little cigars, but your round tins of smokeless tobacco. They don't fit through a cigarette stamping machine. It's impossible. Your pouches of pipe tobacco, they don't fit. Your pouches of roll-your-own tobacco where you make your own cigarettes, they don't fit. There is simply no machine that exists to do that. And if that's one of the goals of the study, we suggest it may be better to have the Department of Revenue analyze the tax windfall that the state's going to receive come July 1. About 2 weeks ago, President Obama signed the Prevented All Cigarette Trafficking Act. It is a law that will significantly reduce or eliminate the buying of cigarettes and smokeless tobacco over the Internet. It requires Internet sellers to charge the state excise taxes and sales taxes and remit those to the state. Right now, most of those sellers don't do that. It also prohibits the U.S. Mail Service from delivering those tobacco products in the mail. DHL, UPS, FedEx have all adopted policies not to deliver tobacco products anymore because they can't assure there's an adult at the home to receive the product. The mail service was the one chief means to deliver those products. This new law, which takes effect July 1, prohibits the U.S. Mail Service from delivering those products. What that means is this. Internet sellers aren't going to have the price advantage of $16, $18, $20 a carton on cigarettes they had anymore. Plus, they can't deliver them. That means Minnesota residents who've bought over the Internet will have to go back to buy at their local stores. Reverting back to buying at the local stores means the state gets a windfall. We calculated it back in 2005, and I sent you all a letter. It's about $25 million. And we're glad to work with the Department of Revenue to finalize that and get it down to a more specific number.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I forgive me for interrupting you here, but I read the letter, I think it was a couple pages, that I think you sent to us. I don't know. It was in my office this morning, and I read it. And I read that where you're calling that a windfall, but isn't it just replacing something we lost when people started purchasing, these products over the Internet? I don't know how long you've been able to buy them, but that's money. I wouldn't call it a windfall, I guess. I sort of thought it insulted my intelligence, but that could be a big or small problem, I really don't think it's a windfall. I just think it's getting money back to the state that we should have and we probably should have been able to have, even for those purchases over the Internet, to be honest with you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Scheid, when this was brought to my attention, we contacted the Department of Revenue to see if there was going to be an additional money come in as a result of the passage of this bill. And I think, I'm not sure if everybody has this, I think everybody has this. It does say the state is unlikely to see any additional revenue until after the end of fiscal year 2011.
Right.
There's this implementation stage. So if it does bring some new money, it's in the next biennium. So,
yeah.
Mr. Bryant?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, no insult was intended. If the terminology was incorrect, I apologize. But this is money the state's been losing for a number of years, and we've been working with Congress for a number of years to pass this very law, as have a lot of anti-tobacco groups. We've all worked together on this. So in one sense, it wouldn't be there otherwise if this law didn't pass, because the same status quo would exist, and we would not be receiving that money. Now we're going to be receiving that money, and we'd like the Department of Revenue to work with us to try and find out exactly how much it is. It's going to be significant. In total, $1.4 billion has been lost by the states every year because of Internet tobacco sales. And now that's going to be coming back to the states because of the congressional action and the signature of the law by the president. Mr. Chairman, there's several other matters I'd like to discuss about the fiscal note. There are several inaccuracies that I'd like to point out. I think it might be helpful for the committee and the Department of Revenue. I've spoken to the Department of Revenue about it, but I think the committee should know about that as well. It would impact the current fiscal note. First, the fiscal note estimates an $800,000 revenue gain by applying the cigarette non-settlement fee to Little Cigars. By way of background, the cigarette non-settlement fee is a 35-cent...
Mr. Brandt?
Yes.
Could the gentleman tell us where he's, what he's pointing out in the revenue...
Mr. Brandt, where on the revenue estimate?
In the narrative of the revenue estimate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, on the first page, it's the fifth line down, cigarette non-settlement fee, 35 cents per pack. They show an additional $800,000 in the first fiscal year and then $900,000 after that. Do you see that on the first page?
Yes, I do now. Thank you.
By way of background, that 35-cent non-settlement fee was assessed on cigarettes made by companies that were not parties to the 1998 Minnesota settlement with the major cigarette manufacturers. Little cigar manufacturers were not a part of that lawsuit, not a part of the settlement. The lawsuit focused in part on advertising of cigarettes to the public, and there was no response by the cigar industry because they weren't involved. To now apply the 35-cent fee through the legislative action, which was intended to only apply to cigarettes, and now to apply it to cigars, will most likely result in a legal challenge because that industry wasn't even involved in that effort. So that could put the additional $800,000 in the first fiscal year and then the additional money in the next fiscal years at risk. Second, the fiscal note states that the wholesale average price for a pack of Little Cigars is 83 cents, and I believe that is on the bottom of the second page. It says the wholesale pack price of Little Cigars is assumed to be 83 cents per pack of 20 for this estimate. I believe that figure is inaccurate. Swisher Sweets, they retail for $6.59 a pack of six. The wholesale cost is $3.50. The 70% tax on this package is approximately $2.45. That's almost double the cigarette tax on the same kind of pack.
But Mr. Bryant, the language you reference, the 83 cents, is assuming a pack of 20.
Exactly. So if this was a pack of 20, you'd have to multiply it by 3 because this is a pack of 6. So your tax amount would even be higher. So if you want to proportionally reduce all this, my point is a lot of these little cigars, Mr. Chairman, are priced much higher than cigarettes. And based on the 70% tax rate, the state receives more tax money under the 70% tax structure than the $1.56 per pack. That was my point. Some of the little cigars are sold very cheaply. And if you apply the $1.56, you might gain some additional revenue on those. But a lot of the other little cigars, you will lose revenue as opposed to gain revenue. Third, the fiscal note also says that there will be a negligible impact on the little cigar industry if you apply the fire-safe cigarette requirements to little cigars. For way of background, several years ago, the legislature adopted a law requiring cigarettes to have a fire-safe paper. It's like speed bump paper to reduce the rate that the cigarettes burn. So if someone puts a cigarette down, it doesn't start a fire on a couch or in a bed. But that standard for that paper was adopted and created by the cigarette manufacturers and the state fire marshals. Again, the little cigar industry was not involved. I don't know of any other state that applies the fire-safe cigarette standard. There is no fire-safe cigarette paper that can be used to wrap little cigars. Little cigars are wrapped in whole leaf.
We deleted that provision. We deleted that provision from our bill.
In the amendment?
Yeah.
Then just disregard those comments because that wouldn't affect that. Finally, the fiscal note states that new tobacco products such as the dissolvable tablets and so forth in the strips are not sold in Minnesota. They are. I picked them up from my wholesaler. It's like these Ariba tablets. And again, as I reiterated before, we are collecting the tax at 70%. We are remitting that, and the current structure already exists to do that. Overall, we have a very effective and efficient tax system. We don't think it needs to be modernized. It's not broke. It doesn't need to be fixed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Does anybody else like to testify? Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I have a few questions, and I wondered, I assume that there's a tax on cigars and it's by weight or something. Do they stamp?
70% of the wholesale price, I believe.
Right. So is there a stamp or any other kind of tax marking on those things?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, no, large cigars are not stamped with any kind of stamp indicia, no.
But Mr. Chairman, are those little, well, not the little ones, but I mean, you can buy like a pack of five or six large cigars, I think I remember.
And I think so, the point is they're taxed at 7% of the wholesale price.
Right, but Mr. Chairman, they don't have a stamp on them. So, I mean, I would think that if we, I don't see why the stamp is hanging us up here, but.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I mean, I just.
Senator Dibble.
Think of Pitney Bowes machines that we have in every mailroom and every office in the country, and they handle all different kinds of shape and manner of mail, and, you know, yeah, making adjustments to those sorts of machines is not a huge deal. So
I do have a question about some of those products, because you said the electronic cigar was a tobacco product. Do you think these things are these little strips that you dissolve in your mouth or you chew or little pouches? I mean, they're tobacco products as well, right? You said they were made of tobacco.
Mr. Chairman,
right.
Senator Scheid, yes, they are made of finely ground tobacco products. It says right on the back. So, yes, they're tobacco products. We agree with that, yes.
So,
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, is there anything, are there warnings on cigars? Are there health warnings on cigars? I saw that one of those little packages said keep out of the reach of children, but I didn't see if there's the, you know, the typical warning that you'll see on a pack of cigarettes. And are these things really out on a counter so children, and can children purchase them? Can they legally purchase them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, children cannot purchase tobacco products. Anyone under 18 is prohibited, nor can retailers sell those to children under 18 years of age. Various warning messages are on various packages of cigars. The federal government regulates the warning labels on cigarettes. And the cigar industry, and maybe Mr. Holton can refer to that as well, do have warning labels or warning statements on packages of cigars as well.
Okay, but I mean, Mr. Chairman, I've read someplace in here that that some of these things like grape or vanilla or chocolate, apparently cigars, and also something else, like these little things that look like breath mints or something that, or the e-cigarettes, that they can sell them to young people. That's just amazing to me. I guess there's no tobacco in there. There's just nicotine.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, that's correct about the e-cigarettes, and so we need to make sure that we address that issue. And then for those products that contain tobacco, currently the tobacco products definition, if you look at page 1 near the bottom and then the top of page 2, mm-hmm, the current definition is very, it's kind of an enumeration. So we list different things, cigars, stogies, I don't know how to say some of these things. Granulated,
flour,
plug cut, crimp cut, ready rubbed, and other smoking tobacco, snuff flour, Cavendish, et cetera. And so what we seek to do is also talk about just, you know, tobacco products more generally. So that we're getting a little bit ahead of the game, a little bit ahead of the market, so that we're dealing with these orbs. You know, these are like little box of mints, kind of, and these little strips that you put on your tongue and get dissolved in these little sticks. I don't even know how you ingest these, but there's these little stick things. I don't even know what you do to them. But right now, the tobacco products definition doesn't acknowledge these, and they could conceivably be sold to kids. So that's part of what we attempt to do in the bill.
Mr. Bryant, do we, on all of these other products with nicotine in them, do we charge? How are they taxed?
Mr. Chairman, our wholesalers consider this as other tobacco products or OTP, and we apply the 70%, 35% tax, 35% health impact fee. If it's a tobacco cessation product like Nicorette gum or the patches that contain nicotine, those we don't sell. Those are pharmaceutical products, and those are not taxed, is my understanding.
Mr. Holton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Court Holton. I represent the Cigar Association of America, and I'm here today in opposition to Senator Dibble's bill, which I do with some reluctance because I've found him to be very much a gentleman and he treats people with respect, so it's not comfortable to oppose him in a committee. Plus, sitting at this chair gives me some trepidation. I've lost millions and millions of dollars over the years sitting in this chair. And
you're going to lose more next year, Mr. Yeah, Old.
I'm aware of that, and I lost a lot today already. I'm here on the cigar part. Some of these products I've never seen before, and I have no opinion on you know whatever you do with those things. This is a cigar, as you all know, and so are these. Now, the industry calls these little cigars, and I heard some testimony today that some of these are basically cigarettes, and they're not cigarettes. These have real cigar tobacco in them. That's what they're made up of, whereas cigarettes have all sorts of gunk in them and stuff like that. These are essentially a miniaturized version of these. Some of them are tipped. Some of them are not. The tipped ones, I guess, are neater to use, and the tip cools down the product. And why am I here today? It's because of these two. I'm not sure what this bill is really intending to do. I don't think it modernizes or streamlines anything. In fact, where we have one classification today, these two things made by two different manufacturers, once this bill were to pass, we'd be splitting these into two groups, one deemed to be a cigarette and taxed like a cigarette, one deemed to be a cigar and taxed like a cigar. The other thing that's curious about that is this is just about the highest OTP state in the union. I think there's four states that are either at or above our OTP tax of 70%. If, even with the amendment, this language were to become law, this would disappear. Combination of the competitive advantage that this company would have and the stamping issue, which is, in fact, a real issue. There is no stamping machine for the tons of cigar products. You've got cigars that come in threes, fives, tens, 20, 25s, all different shapes of packaging. When Kansas was considering this, they declined to go ahead and do it after talking to Pennsylvania and reflecting upon the regulatory nightmare that it would be. But this product is made by the largest cigarette company in the world, and they would not be touched by this bill. All of my members fall into this category, and all of these would be touched by this bill. And I have a hard time understanding why that would be a good legislative policy, because this company will end up inheriting all of the business in the state of Minnesota, and these guys will just simply not be able to sell this product here, although the product will still be here. So in terms of whatever this has to do with underage smoking or anything like that, you know, that's not going to change. What's going to change is this company is going to be a big winner. And that is one of the major problems that we have with this. If you really wanted to get after things that look like a cigarette, you wouldn't need to use a weight figure in your definition. If you wanted to say if they got a filter on them and they're not wrapped in whole tobacco, then everybody would be treated the same. But when you use that weight figure, the one product, it used to be John Middleton Corporation, but it was purchased recently, that company would still be in business, and these companies are all going to be out of business in Minnesota. On the tax part, I'm hearing it both ways, and they say it's going to raise the taxes of these, and there's going to be revenue for the state. At 70%, I have a hard time believing that the state would make money on this by going to a cigarette tax for some of these products, because they're presently taxed at 70%. And in terms of administration, the OTP tax is simple. Here's your wholesaler's invoice. Add 70% to it, at 70%, and send the check to the state. That's about as simple as you can get. You start trying to deal with all of these products individually, and I think you're going to have a real nightmare on your hands. So I'm hoping that this bill needs a lot of work, in my opinion, and I'm hoping that we do that rather than rush to judgment. And that reminds me of, you know, this last 8 years in this tax committee has been rather different, somewhat strange. When I first walked in and sat in this chair originally, Bill McCutcheon was sitting in your chair, Mr. Chairman, and I've been around for a long time, but in the last 8 years, I think I'm the only guy that's gotten his taxes increased in the state of Minnesota. That's the same client I'm here representing today. We got a whopping increase a few years ago, as you know, where they doubled our tax. At the risk of rambling, I will stop and attempt to answer any questions.
Senator Dibbler, I'm familiar with the weight-based snuff issue, and it seems like one of the companies was introducing some legislation to put the legislature kind of into a fight between two companies that had different product lines. Are we unintentionally with this bill kind of injecting the legislature into a dispute between two different manufacturers that make different products? This is going to affect one of the companies and not the others, all likely unintentionally. It sounds like it's similar to the weight-based snuff issue relative to one company could benefit from this legislation and the other would be very negatively impacted, and they're both tobacco companies. Is that
– Oh, well, Mr. Chair, I think we tried to address some of that in the amendment. I don't know if Mr. Holton read the amendment or not, but, you know, we do specify that we are not seeking to capture those products that are rolled in whole tobacco leaf and do not have a filter. You know, that's this, you know, but it's not this. This is what we're trying to get a hold of, this right here. This is paper with a little bit of tobacco in it, and it has this filter that's a part of it. And I don't think anyone, and the language, the first part of the definition says, is likely to be offered, purchased by, or consumed by consumers as a cigarette. So this is what we're attempting to address.
Senator Dole, why didn't we say in packs of 20? Other states have been through this. I suspect the advocates experienced something like the testimony we just heard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, all I can say is that we worked very closely with the Department of Revenue to come up with the definition of cigarette with very much the intention of just drawing a tight circle around these types of products. and we felt and they felt that they could administer, and that our intention, we were fulfilling the intention to just capture these types of products and not capture the cigarillos or the large cigars. And so in terms of putting in the packs of 20, I'll defer to you. We had lots of iterations of the language, and so I can't give you a good answer of why that wasn't included. But.
So Mr. Chair, I mean, it's conceivable that these could be sold in packs of less than 20 to once again, get around the tax. You know, these are larger. They don't have the filter. You know, they're more like cigars, the cigars that we traditionally think of. We don't capture these. But, you know, if folks wanted to, you know, create a smaller cigar wrapped in a tobacco leaf with the little tip, again, they wouldn't be captured.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I did have a chance to study the amendment, and the definitional subsections are conjunctive, not disjunctive. I mean, if you meet any one of those, the leaving the 4.5 pounds in creates this distinction between these companies and is not relevant to the purposes that I heard the advocates testifying on today. If you could describe one of those products perfectly without using a weight-based delineation. But when you use that weight-based delineation, this company doesn't make a product that's under 5 pounds per thousand. Just about all of the other companies' products are less than 4.5 pounds per thousand. And as you can imagine, they're not too tickled by this development, by this portion of this. Like I said, the other parts of the bill are not of my, I'm not concerned about those.
Ms. Gordon, why the reference to weight-based?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll offer that if Minnesota does go forward and pass this bill, we'll be the 13th state in the nation, including federal government, that does, for purposes of taxation, look at little cigars as cigarettes. The difference will be in Minnesota's law, and Iowa's one of those states, one of the members. The difference is we're moving from bumping the weight up to 4.5 pounds or less per thousand. It's traditionally set at 3 pounds or less per thousand, and what we've seen at the federal level in other states is what manufacturers do is they just tinker with the weights a little bit, bump them up above 3 pounds or less per thousand to evade being considered a cigarette, because typically the tobacco tax would be less if they're considered other tobacco products. So we actually think that it's quite important to have the weight distinction there, to have it at 4.5 pounds or less per thousand, so that we're truly capturing and taking away the manufacturer's ability to kind of tinker with their weights to get around complying with the proper taxation. And the Department of Revenue may be able to comment on that as well, because we spoke up quite a bit with them.
Ms. Holton? Mr. Chairman, I believe if you have your staff check into it, you'll find out that most of those other states being referred to use the federal 3 pounds per thousand definition. And that, you know, there's a lot of difference between this and one of the cigarette-type things that Senator Dibble showed you.
Mr. Bryant?
Mr. Chairman, Jen, one last comment just to reiterate. We'd be glad to work with the department because we think the state is going to lose tax revenue since so many of these little cigar products are priced higher than cigarettes. And based on the 70% current tax rate, you're not going to bring in that same revenue. We can work with our wholesalers, break down the percent of sales that little cigars are, and try and come to a much more definitive figure. We'd be glad to work with them on that. We just don't want the state to lose tax revenue. And if you do adopt the bill, you'd probably see a reduction in price of little cigar products, which I don't think the Clearway representative would like to see either. Well, we don't. That's one unintended consequence, is possible reduction in prices of tobacco products.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I did want to respond to one other point in the testimony, and that was whether or not the this is the first point about the revenue note and the settlement fee.
35 cents.
Yeah. Really, the language that we need to pay attention to is the definition of cigarette in the settlement agreement. And I'll just read that. It says, cigarette means any product which contains nicotine is intended to be burned or heated under ordinary conditions of use and consists of or contains any roll of tobacco wrapped in paper or in any substance not containing tobacco or tobacco in any form that is functional in the product, which because of its appearance, the type of tobacco used in the filter or in its packaging and labeling is likely to be offered to or purchased by consumers as a cigarette. And it goes on from there. So I just disagree with whether or not that fee is properly construed and applied to once we, if we adopt this this bill, would be construed to be applied to a product like this. I think it clearly would be. And the House Counsel has looked at this question in some detail, and they had some role in its crafting and the supporting statutory language and concur with our point of view.
Sir Dibble, what about the issue of cigars and display cases?
Oh, we do have to settle that, figure that out. That's a valid point that he brought up. Yeah, we need to resolve that. We should not have that apply to tobacco stores.
The department? Who wants to get into the tobacco wars?
Mr. Chair, did you want specific questions regarding tobacco and some of the questions, and that would be for Mr. Lang?
Ms. Cadoon, let's start with the 35-cent a pack issue. Should that have been scored on the revenue estimate or not? And who from the department is an expert on this?
I don't. This is, I think, tax research.
Mr. Chair, members, we'll have to get back to you with that answer.
Apparently, there's a question there that we need to have resolved.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Any members, any questions of the department? What's the department's response to the industry's assertion that there's not a feasible way to put stamps on some of these odd size packaging that you see in the little cigar market?
Mr. Chair, Wayne Lang with the Department of Revenue, members of the committee. I don't disagree with that. Mr. Bryan is correct. We only have a stamp for cigarettes. The majority of cigarettes are stamped, I'd say 95% of them, through a high-speed machine. However, we do have an ability to stamp odd-sized packs of cigarettes with a hand-stamp application. So the technology can be dumbed down to the point of odd configurations. It's not impossible to conceive of a stamp for any configuration of tobacco product. In fact, the current stamp manufacturer would be capable of creating such a stamp for other tobacco products. So, but he isn't correct. There is some concern about high-speed stamping of non-traditional packaging of something that we used to just, you know, stamp cigarettes that way.
And to the point of that, in some of the way some of those are packaged, 5 in a package, 8 in a package, whatever it is, that 70% of the wholesale price actually brings more revenue to the state than a stamp would. What's the department's position on that? Is that accurate?
I don't know if I'm the department on this one, but my position of being around tobacco is for 25 years, it's accurate. There's any band of prices for tobacco products, and there are certain small cigars that are priced quite substantially higher than like a Winchester or a little cigar pack like cigarettes. So the tax, we probably, in certain cases, if we were to tax something currently, which is now taxed at 70% tax and fee, and went to a cigarette tax rate of $1.56, all taxes and fees, we might lose some money. But I don't have any idea how much that would be. No, it's... It would be the little cigars as well.
any way for the department to calculate that in this revenue estimate?
I don't know. I hesitate to speak for the tax research people because some of these industry numbers are really hard to get a handle on.
Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for revenue estimates, obviously they take the best information they have at the time when they put together the revenue estimate. And they get more information from the industry and others, they're more than willing and happy to look at that. So they can certainly, if there's more information now available, they can certainly look at that information and see if that would change the revenue estimate that's now before you.
Ms. Cadoon, do I remember that we actually reimburse or charge for affixing the stamp? It seemed to me there's some cost issue relative to we reimburse for putting the stamp on or what's
Mr. Chair, there had been a
Mr. Lang?
There had been a discount at one time. That discount was eliminated several years ago.
Mr. Chairman, Wayne Lang from the department is correct. We used to get reimbursed a small percentage of the cost of the cigarette stamp to stamp cigarettes. That was repealed as part of a budget resolution bill about 4 or 5 years ago. Our wholesalers pay for the machines. They're about $100,000 per machine. We pay for the stamps that we purchase from the state. So the state can, we pay for that. We pay for the shipping to get the stamps from the Department of Revenue to our wholesale. So we pay for everything regarding that with no reimbursement.
Okay. Mr. Ryan, thank you. Senator Dibble, it seems like there's some issues around the little cigars. I don't know if there's time yet in this session to resolve that. But, Ms. Cadoon, what's the administration have a position on extending the stamping tax to these products? The fact that the revenue estimate raises money, what's the position relative to the governor's bright line on taxes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've not spoken to the governor's office regarding this bill specifically, so I always figure the prudent course of action isn't to weigh in, you know, firmly one way or the other on this. I would think, though, if you looked at kind of the recent past history as an indicator, I would think if you're looking at a total tax bill, you'd probably need one. If you have a tax increase, revenue increase, you'd probably need an offsetting revenue decrease.
Mr. Lang, thank you. Any other questions of the committee of Mr. Lang?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cadoon. Senator Langseth.
When it comes to the tax on cigarettes, now there's two taxes, as I understand, one per pack and then the other, the sales tax. Is that correct? How much is the per pack?
There's actually three factors. The cigarette tax, it hasn't changed for some time, I think since 88. 48 cents a pack for a pack of 20, 24 mils per cigarette. The health impact fee per pack of 20 cigarettes is 75 cents. And then the sales tax is a number that changes every year on August 1st. And that is currently 33 cents. And we set that based on a weighted average price for a pack of cigarettes statewide. Once a year we do that with our tax research department division.
So that's an in-lieu sales tax?
In lieu of, well, it's not in lieu. It's cigarette sales tax. It's collected now at the wholesale level rather than the retail level. So the retailers no longer collect and remit sales tax on cigarettes. That's charged at the wholesale level.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
I'm thinking of the difference here, most of this is per pack, and it'll stay the same until we change it. The 70% will change just based upon evaluation, right?
Correct.
I don't know what's happened to the value that is a 70% is applied to, but I would imagine over a period of time it would go up, right?
Mr. Lang, do we know our wholesale is the 70% number, OTC number. Is that number been moving up?
Yeah, with
based
the,
on volume or what's been happening?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, the OTP tax has been going up. Well, in fact, it just about doubled when the 35% tax was included with a 35% health impact fee. But traditionally, over time, the amount of OTP tax collections, we used to be able to chart this pretty. It used to be represent about 10% of what cigarette collections were. So if we would collect $175 million in cigarette taxes for a year, we would look to OTP taxes to be about $16 to $18 million a year. But, no, the numbers are going steadily up as prices go up on product and certain things.
Senator Double.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to your earlier point about whether or not we can solve this problem. First of all, I think we've gotten pretty close on the small cigar thing to the extent that we need to make tweak a little bit. I don't think it's a problem that we can't resolve between now and end of session, and I would hate to lose the opportunity to address this issue with these emerging products coming to the market that have kids, right in their crosshairs. I mean, these are chocolate cigarettes, and they're trying to construe them as cigars. These are even worse. They really smell bad. They're grape. They're cigarettes. They're trying to construe as cigars, sell them for really cheap, and evade the taxes at the same time. I mean, to the extent that, there are actual cigars out, I mean, I don't think kids are going to run around and smoke these, certainly not like these.
Sir Dibble, is there a stamp on that? It looked like there's a...
No, this is just a price tag.
Oh, okay.
$4.95 for two packs. Super cheap, sweet, candy-like, for all intents and purposes, are cigarettes. I'd hate to lose the opportunity to really get a handle on what amounts to a couple of things going on that I think we really do need to address as a state. Targeting kids with a cheap product and evading taxes, taxes that they should pay for cigarettes at the same time. I think we can address, this and this product if we're capturing these inadvertently.
Mr. Lang, what happens when cigarettes are packaged two in a packaging, buy one, get one free? Do we get tax on both packs? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. Minnesota law requires both packs of cigarettes have to be stamped, and even if the manufacturer wants to give them away, we get the tax on both packs.
Any other questions, members? Senator Dibble, I think we have a little work to do on the little cigar part. I mean, I understand all these emerging products, I think, and getting those out of the reach of children, I think, is a good thing. But I think we have a little work to do on the cigar part of it yet. So you want to work on that tomorrow, and maybe we can get somewhere with it. But it seems like this stamping issue might be something we can be hard to overcome in a day or two. But Charlie, is anything for this, Senator Dibble?
No, Mr. Chair, unless members.
Charlie's over Senate File 3055 as amended.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, we're going to meet next Tuesday, 9 a.m. We kind of hope to have a bill put together to be able to walk through. Senator Rest.
Private question.
Oh. Okay, the committee's adjourned.